Chapter 63. That the soul is not a temperament, as Galen asserted. The opinion of the physician Galen about the soul is akin to the aforesaid opinion of Alexander concerning the possible intellect, for he says that the soul is a temperament. He was moved to make this assertion by the fact that we see resulting from various temperaments in us, various passions which are ascribed to the soul for some who have, for example, a choleric temperament, are easily angered, while melancholic persons are prone to be sad. Consequently, the same arguments avail to disprove this opinion, as were adduced against the opinion of Alexander, as well as some that apply specially thereto. For it was proved above, that the operation of the vegetative soul, sensitive knowledge and, much more, the operation of the intellect surpass the power of the active and passive qualities. Therefore the temperament cannot be the principle of the soul's operations, and consequently, it is impossible for the soul to be the temperament. Again, seeing that the temperament is something set up by contrary qualities as a kind of mean between them, it cannot possibly be a substantial form, because substance has no contrary, nor is it a recipient of more or less. But the soul is a substantial, not an accidental, form, else a thing would not obtain species or form from its soul. Therefore the soul is not the temperament. Further, the temperament does not move an animal's body by local movement, for it would follow the movement of the predominant element, and thus would always be moved downwards. But the soul moves the body in all directions. Therefore the soul is not the temperament. Moreover, the soul rules the body, and curbs the passions that result from the temperament. For by temperament some are more prone than others to desire or anger, and yet refrain more from these things, on account of something that keeps them in check, as may be seen in those who are continent. But the temperament does not this. Therefore the soul is not the temperament. Apparently he was deceived through failing to observe that passions are ascribed to the temperament in one way, and to the soul in another. For they are ascribed to the temperament as causing a disposition, and in respect of that which is material in the passions, for instance the heat of the blood and the like, whereas they are ascribed to the soul as their principal cause, and in respect of what is formal in the passions, for instance the desire of vengeance in anger. Chapter 64. That the soul is not a harmony. Not unlike the foregoing opinion is the view of those who say that the soul is a harmony, for they meant that the soul is a harmony not of sound, but of contraries, whereof they observed animate bodies to be composed. In the De Anima, this opinion is apparently set down to Empedocles. Gregory of Nyssa, 469, ascribes it to Dinarchus, and it is to be refuted in the same way as the foregoing opinion, as well as by arguments proper to itself. For every mixed body has harmony and temperament. Nor can harmony move a body, nor rule it, nor curb the passions, any more than temperament can do so. Again, it is subject to intention and remission, like temperament. All of which show that the soul is neither harmony nor temperament. Again, the notion of harmony applies more to the qualities of the body than to those of the soul, for health is harmony of the humors, strength of sinews and bones, beauty of limbs and colors, whereas it cannot be said of what things sense or intellect or other parts of the soul are the harmony. Therefore the soul is not a harmony. Moreover, harmony is taken in two senses, in one way, for the composition itself, in another for the manner of composition. Now the soul is not a composition, because each part of the soul would have to be the composition of some of the parts of the body, and this cannot be verified. Likewise, it is not the manner of a composition, because, since in the various parts of the body there are various manners or proportions of composition, each part of the body would have a distinct soul, for bone, flesh, and sinew would have different souls, since they are composed in different proportions, which is clearly false. Therefore the soul is not a harmony. Chapter 65. That the soul is not a body. There were also others who wandered further from the truth, by asserting that the soul is a body. And although these had different and various opinions, it will suffice to refute them here in general. For living things, since they are physical beings, are composed of matter and form. Now they are composed of a body, and of a soul which makes them actually living. Therefore one of these must be the form, and the other the matter. But the body cannot be the form, since the body is not in something else as its matter and subject. Therefore the soul is the form. Consequently it is not a body, Since no form is a body, again, it is impossible for two bodies to coincide. Now the soul is not apart from the body while the latter lives. Therefore the soul is not a body. Moreover, every body is divisible, and whatever is divisible requires something to keep together and unite its parts. Consequently, if the soul were a body, it would have something else to hold it together, and this yet more would be the soul, since we observe that when the soul departs the body perishes, and if this again be divisible, we must at length either come to something indivisible and incorporeal, which will be the soul, or we shall go on to infinity, which is impossible. Therefore the soul is not a body, again, as we proved above, and as it is proved in innate physics. Self-mover is composed of two parts, of which the one is mover, the other moved. Now an animal is a self-mover, and the mover therein is the soul, while the body is moved. Consequently the soul is an unmoved mover. But no body moves without being moved, as we proved above. Consequently the soul is not a body. Further, it was proved above, that intelligence cannot be the act of a body, but it is the act of a soul. Therefore, at least the intellective soul is not a body. As to the arguments by which some have tried to prove that the soul is a body, it is easy to solve them, for they prove that the soul is a body from the son being like his father even in the accidents of the soul, notwithstanding that the son is begotten of his father by bodily detachment. Also because the soul suffers with the body, also because it is separate from the body, and separation is between bodies that touch one another. But against this it has been already stated, that the bodily temperament is somewhat the cause of the soul's passions by way of a dispositive cause. Again, the soul does not suffer with the body except accidentally because, since it is the form of the body, it is moved accidentally through the body being moved. Also the soul is separate from the body, not as that which touches from that which is touched, but as form from matter, although there is a certain contact between the incorporeal and the body, as we have shown. Moreover many men were moved to take up this position through believing that there is nothing that is not a body, being unable to outstrip their imagination which is only about bodies. Wherefore this opinion is put forward in the person of the foolish as saying of the soul, the breath in our nostrils is smoke, and speech a spark to move our heart. Chapter 66. Against those who say that intellect and sense are the same. Some of the early philosophers came near to these through thinking that intellect differs not from sense. But this is impossible, for sense is found in all animals, whereas animals other than man have no intellect. This is evident from the fact that they do diverse and opposite things, not as though they had intelligence, but as moved by nature, performing certain determinate operations that are uniform within the same species. Thus every swallow builds its nest in the same say. Therefore intellect is not the same as sense. Further, sense is not cognizant except of singulars, for every sensitive power knows by individual species, since it receives the species of things in corporeal organs. But the intellect is cognizant of universals, as evidenced by experience. Therefore intellect differs from sense. Moreover, the knowledge of the senses does not extend beyond things corporeal. This is clear from the fact that sensible qualities, which are the proper objects of the senses, are only in corporeal things, and without them the senses know nothing. On the other hand the intellect knows things incorporeal, for instance, wisdom, truth, and the relations of things. Therefore intellect and sense are not the same. Again, sense knows neither itself nor its operation, for sight neither sees itself, nor sees that it sees, but this belongs to a higher power, as is proved in De Anima. But the intellect knows itself, and knows that it understands. Therefore intellect is not the same as sense. Further, sense is corrupted by an excelling sensible, but intellect is not corrupted by the excellence of the intelligible. In fact, he who understands greater things, can afterwards better understand lesser things. Therefore the sensitive power differs from the intellective. Chapter 67. Against those who say that the possible intellect is the imagination. The opinion of those who held that the possible intellect is not distinct from the imagination, was akin to the foregoing. But this is evidently false, for imagination is also in other animals. A sign of this is that in the absence of sensibles they shun or seek them, which would not be the case did they not retain an imaginary apprehension of them. But intellect is not in them, since they offer no evidence of intelligent action. Therefore, imagination and intellect are not the same. Further, imagination is only about things corporeal and singular, since the fancy is a movement caused by actual sensation, as stated in De Anima. But the intellect is about universals and incorporeal things. Therefore, the possible intellect is not the imagination. Moreover, it is impossible for the same thing to be mover and moved. Now the phantasms move the possible intellect, as sensibles move the senses, as Aristotle states. Therefore, the possible intellect cannot be the same as the imagination. Further, it is proved in 3 De Anima, that the intellect is not an act of a part of the body, whereas the imagination has a determinate bodily organ. Therefore, the imagination is not the same as the possible intellect. Hence it is said, who teacheth us more than the beasts of the earth, and instructeth us more than the fowls of the air? Whereby we are given to understand that man has a cognitive power above sense and imagination, which are in other animals. Chapter 68. How an intellectual substance can be the form of the body. Accordingly, from the foregoing arguments we are able to conclude that an intellectual substance can be united to the body as its form. For if an intellectual substance is not united to the body merely as its mover, as Plato stated, nor is in contact with it merely by the phantasms, as Averroes held, but as its form, and if the intellect whereby man understands is not a preparedness in human nature, as Alexander maintained, nor the temperament, as Galen said, nor harmony, according to Empedocles, nor a body, nor the senses or imagination, as the ancients asserted, it follows that the human soul is an intellectual substance united to the body as its form. This can be made evident as follows. For one thing to be another's substantial form, two conditions are required. One of them is that the form be the principle of substantial being to the thing of which it is the form, and I speak not of the effective but of the formal principle, whereby a thing is, and is called a being. Hence follows the second condition, namely that the form and matter combine together in one being, which is not the case with the effective principle together with that to which it gives being. This is the being in which a composite substance subsists, which is one in being, and consists of matter and form. Now an intellectual substance, as proved above, is not hindered by the fact that it is subsistent, from being the formal principle of being to matter, as communicating its being to matter. For it is not unreasonable that the composite and its form itself should subsist in the same being, since the composite exists only by the form, nor does either subsist apart from the other. It may however be argued that an intellectual substance cannot communicate its being to corporeal matter, so that the intellectual substance and the corporeal matter have together one being, because different genera have different modes of being, and a more noble mode belongs to a more noble substance. This would be said reasonably if this being belonged in the same way to matter as to the intellectual substance. But it is not so, for it belongs to corporeal matter as its recipient and subject raised to something higher, while it belongs to the intellectual substance as its principle, and in accordance with its very nature. Wherefore nothing prevents an intellectual substance from being the human body's form, which is the human soul. In this way we are able to perceive the wondrous connection of things, for we always find the lowest in the higher genus touching the highest of the lower genus. Thus some of the lowest of the animal kind scarcely surpass the life of plants, such as oysters, which are immovable, have only the sense of touch, and are fixed to the earth like plants. Hence blessed Dionysius says that divine wisdom has united the ends of higher things with the beginnings of the lower. Accordingly we may consider something supreme in the genus of bodies, namely the human body equably attempered, which touches the lowest of the higher genus, namely the human soul, and this occupies the last degree in the genus of intellectual substances, as may be seen from its mode of understanding. Hence it is that the intellectual soul is said to be on the horizon and confines of things corporeal and incorporeal, inasmuch as it is an incorporeal substance, and yet the form of a body. And a thing is not less one that is composed of an intellectual substance and corporeal matter, than that which results from the form of fire and its matter, but perhaps more so, since the more a form overcomes matter, the more one is that which is made from it and matter. Now though form and matter have one being, it does not follow that matter always equals the being of the form. In fact, the more noble the form, the more it surpasses matter in its being. This is clear to one who looks into the operations of forms, from the consideration of which we know their natures, since a thing operates according as it is. Consequently, a form whose operation surpasses the condition of matter, itself also surpasses matter in the excellence of its being, for we find certain lowest forms, which are capable of no operation except such as comes within the compass of the qualities which are the dispositions of matter, for instance heat, cold, moisture and dryness, rarity, density, gravity and levity, and the like. Such are the elemental forms. Consequently, these forms are altogether material, and wholly merged in matter. Above these we find the forms of mixed bodies, and these, although they do not extend to any operations that cannot be accomplished through the aforesaid qualities, nevertheless sometimes produce those effects by a higher power which they receive from the heavenly bodies, and which is consequent upon their species. Thus the lodestone attracts iron. Again, above these we find certain forms whose operations include some which surpass the power of the aforesaid qualities, although the same qualities assist organically in their operation. Such are the souls of plants, and these again are like not only to the powers of heavenly bodies, in surpassing the active and passive qualities, but also to the movers of heavenly bodies, inasmuch as they are the principles of movement in living things, which move themselves. Above these forms we find other forms like the higher substances, not only in moving, but also in knowing, and thus they are capable of operations to which the aforesaid qualities do not help even organically, and yet these operations are not accomplished save by means of a corporeal organ. Such are the souls of dumb animals. For sensation and imagination are not accomplished by heating and cooling, although these are necessary for the due disposition of the organ. And above all these forms we find a form like the higher substances, even as regards the kind of knowledge, which is intelligence, and thus it is capable of an operation which is accomplished without any corporeal organ at all. This is the intellective soul, for intelligence is not affected by a corporeal organ. Consequently, it follows that this principle whereby man understands, namely the intellective soul, which surpasses the condition of corporeal matter, is not wholly encompassed by and merged in matter, as other material forms. This is indicated by its operation, in which corporeal matter has no part. And yet, since the human soul's active intelligence needs powers, namely imagination and sense, which operate through corporeal organs, this by itself shows that the soul is naturally united to the body in order to complete the human species. Chapter 69. Solution of the arguments by which it was proved above that an intellectual substance cannot be united to the body as its form. Taking the foregoing into consideration, it is not difficult to solve the arguments given above against the aforesaid union. In the first argument, something false is taken for granted, because body and soul are not two actually existing substances, but one actually existing substance is made from them, for man's body is not actually the same while the soul is present, and when the soul is absent, and it is the soul that makes it to be actually. The statement, contained in the second objection, that form and matter belong to the same genus, is true, not as though they were both species of the same genus, but because they are the principles of the same species. Accordingly, the intellectual substance and the body, which if they existed apart would be species of different genera, through being united are of the same genus as principles thereof. Nor does it follow that the intellectual substance is a material form, although its being is in matter, as the third argument contended. For it is not in matter as merged in matter, or wholly encompassed by matter, but in another way, as stated. Nor does the intellectual substance being united to the body as its form prevent the intellect being separate from the body, as the philosophers say. For we must consider in the soul both its essence and its power. According to its essence it gives being to such and such a body, while according to its power it accomplishes its proper operations. If therefore an operation of the soul be accomplished by means of a corporeal organ, it follows that the power which is the principle of that operation is the act of that part of the body by which its operation is accomplished. Thus sight is the act of the eye. If, however, its operation be not accomplished by means of a corporeal organ, its power will not be the act of a body. It is in this sense that the intellect is said to be separate, and this does not preclude the substance of the soul, of which the intellect is a power, otherwise the intellective soul, from being the act of the body, as the form which gives being to such a body. And although the soul by its substance is the form of the body, it is not necessary that its every operation be performed by means of the body, and that consequently, its every power be the act of a body, as the fifth argument supposed. For it has been already shown that the human soul is not such a form as is wholly merged in matter, but is of all other forms raised highest above matter. Consequently it can produce an operation without the body, as being independent of the body in operating, since not even in being does it depend on the body. In the same way it is clear that the reasons whereby Averroes tries to confirm his opinion, do not prove that the intellectual substance is not united to the body as its form. For the expressions used by Aristotle in reference to the possible intellect, when he says that it is impassible, unmixed, and separate, do not oblige us to admit that the intellective substance is not united to the body as the form whence the latter has being. For they are also true if we say that the intellective power, which Aristotle calls the power of understanding, is not the act of an organ, as though it exercised its operation thereby. This is in fact shown by his proof, since he proves that it is unshackled and separate from its operation whereby it understands all things. And because operation belongs to a power as to its principle, it is consequently clear that neither does Aristotle's proof show that the intellective substance is not united to the body as its form. For if we suppose that the soul's substance is thus united to the body in being, and that the intellect is not the act of any organ, it will not follow that the intellect has a particular nature. I refer to the natures of sensibles, since it is not admitted to be a harmony, nor the reason of an organ. As Aristotle says of sense that it is like the reason of an organ, for the intellect is not a common operation with the body. That Aristotle, by saying that the intellect is unshackled or separate, does not mean to exclude its being a part or power of the soul which is the form of the whole body, is clear from what he says at the end of the first book of De Anima, against those who said that different parts of the soul are in different parts of the body. If the whole soul contains the whole body, it is meet that each of its parts should contain some part of the body. But this seems impossible, for it is difficult to conceive what part the intellect contains and how. It is also evident, since the intellect is not the act of any part of the body, that its receptiveness is not that of primary matter, for as much as its receptiveness and operation are altogether without a corporeal organ. Nor again is the infinite power of the intellect excluded, since its power is not ascribed to a magnitude, but is founded on the intellectual substance, as stated. Chapter 70. That according to the words of Aristotle we must say that the intellect is united to the body as its form. Now, since Averroes endeavours to confirm his opinion especially by appealing to the words and proof of Aristotle, it remains to be shown that according to Aristotle's opinion we must say that the intellect as to its substance is united to a body as its form. For Aristotle in the eighth book of Physics, comma, proves that in movers and things moved it is impossible to go on to infinity, whence he concludes that we must needs come to some first moved thing, which either is moved by an immovable mover, or moves itself. Of these two he takes the latter, namely that the first movable moves itself, for this reason, that what is per se always precedes that which is by another. Then he shows that a self-mover is of necessity divided into two parts, one of which is mover and the other moved. Consequently the first self-mover must consist of two parts, the one moving, the other moved. Now every such thing is animate. Wherefore the first movable, namely the heaven, is animate according to the opinion of Aristotle. Hence in 2 Decalo, comma, it is expressly stated that the heaven is animate, and for this reason we must ascribe to the heaven differences of position not only in relation to us, but also in relation to itself. Let us then inquire with what kind of soul, according to Aristotle's opinion, the heaven is animated. In 11 Metaphysics, he proves that in the heaven's movement we may consider something that moves and is wholly unmoved, and something that moves and is also moved. Now that which moves and is wholly unmoved, moves as an object of desire, desirable of course by that which is moved, and he shows that it moves not as desirable by the desire of concupiscence, which is the desire of sense, but as desirable by intellectual desire. Wherefore he says that the first unmoved mover is desirable and intellectual. Consequently that which is moved by it, namely the heaven, is desiring and understanding in a more noble way than we are, as he proves further on. Therefore the heaven is composed, according to Aristotle's opinion, of an intellectual soul and a body. He refers to this when he says to De Anima, that in certain things there is the faculty and act of understanding, for instance in men, and in any other like or more noble things, namely the heaven. Now it is clear that the heaven has not a sensitive soul, according to the opinion of Aristotle, since it would have various organs, which is not in keeping with the heaven's simplicity. In order to point this out, Aristotle goes on to say that those corruptible things which have intellect have all the other powers, so as to imply that some incorruptible things, namely the heavenly bodies, have intellect without the other powers of the soul. Therefore it cannot be said that the intellect comes into contact with the heavenly bodies through phantasms, but we must say that the intellect, by its substance, is united to the heavenly body as its form. Consequently, since the human body is the most noble of all lower bodies, and by the equability of its temperament is most like the heaven, which is free of all contrariety, it follows that in the opinion of Aristotle, the intellectual substance is united to the human body not by any phantasms, but as its form. As regards what we have said about the heaven being animate, we have not said it as though we asserted it to be in keeping with the teaching of faith, to which it matters not whether we state it to be so or otherwise. Hence Augustine says, "Nor do I consider it as certain whether the sun, moon, and all the stars belong to the same company, i.e., of the angels, although some think them to be bodies endowed with light, without sense or intelligence." Chapter 71. That the soul is united to the body immediately. We are able to conclude from the foregoing that the soul is united to the body immediately, nor must we admit any medium as uniting the soul to the body, whether it be the phantasms, as Averroes maintained, or its powers, as some say, or the corporeal spirit, as others have asserted. For it has been proved, that the soul is united to the body as its form. Now a form is united to matter without any medium whatever, since to be the act of such and such a body is competent to a form by its very nature and not by anything else. Consequently neither is there anything that makes one thing out of matter and form, except the agent which reduces the potentiality to act, as Aristotle proves. For matter and form are related as potentiality and act. It may be said, however, that there is a medium between the soul and the body, not in the point of being, but as regards movement and in the order of generation. As regards movement, since in the movement whereby the soul moves the body there is a certain order among moved and movers, for the soul produces all its operations through its powers, so that it moves the body by means of its power, and again the members by means of the vital spirit, and again one organ by means of another. In the order of generation dispositions to a form precede the form in matter, although they are posterior thereto in being. Consequently the body's dispositions whereby it is rendered the proper perfectible subject of such and such a form, may in that sense be described as a medium between the soul and body. Chapter 72. That the whole soul is in the whole body and in each part thereof. From the same premises we can prove that the whole soul is in the whole body, and in each part thereof, for the proper act must be in its proper perfectible subject. Now the soul is the act of an organic body, not of one organ only. Therefore it is in the whole body, and not only in one part, according to its essence whereby it is the form of the body. And the soul is the form of the whole body in such a way as to be also the form of each part. For were it the form of the whole and not of the parts, it would not be the substantial form of that body. Thus the form of a house, which is the form of the whole and not of each part, is merely an accidental form. That it is the substantial form both of the whole and of the parts, is clear from the fact that both the whole and the parts take their species from it. Wherefore, when it departs, neither whole nor parts retain the same species, for the eye or flesh of a dead person are only so called equivocally. If the soul is the act of each part, and an act is in the thing of which it is the act, it follows that it is by its essence in each part of the body. That this applies to the whole soul is evident, for since whole denotes relation to parts, it follows that whole is taken in various senses, according to the various meanings of parts. Now part is taken in two ways. First, forasmuch as a thing is divided according to quantity, thus 2 cubits is a part of 3 cubits. Secondly, For as much as a thing is divided by a division of its essence, thus form and matter are said to be parts of a composite. Hence a whole is spoken of in reference both to quantity and to essential perfection. Now whole and part in reference to quantity are not applicable to form save accidentally, namely in so far as they are divided when the quantitative subject is divided. On the other hand, whole or part in reference to essential perfection is found in forms by their very nature. Speaking then of this kind of totality, which is applicable to forms by their very nature, it is clear regarding every form that the whole of it is in the whole subject, and the whole of it in each part thereof, for just as whiteness is in a whole body in respect of the whole essence of whiteness, so is it in each part thereof. It is otherwise with the totality which is ascribed to forms accidentally, for in this sense we cannot say that the whole whiteness is in each part. Accordingly, if there be a form that is not divided when its subject is divided, as the souls of perfect animals, there will be no need for a distinction, since only one totality is applicable to them, and we must say absolutely that the whole of it is in each part of the body. Nor is this difficult to conceive for one who understands that the soul is not indivisible in the same way as a point, and that an incorporeal is not united to a corporeal being in the same way as bodies are united together, as we have expounded above. Nor is it inconsistent that the soul, since it is a simple form, should be the act of parts so various, because the matter of every form is adapted to it according to its requirements. Now the more noble and simple a form is, the greater is its power, and consequently the soul, which is the noblest of the lower forms, though simple in substance, is manifold in power and has many operations. Wherefore it needs various organs in order to accomplish its operations, of which organs the various powers of the soul are said to be the acts, for instance sight of the eye, hearing of the ears, and so forth. For this reason perfect animals have the greatest variety of organs, while plants have the least. This explains why certain philosophers have stated that the soul is in some particular part of the body. Thus Aristotle says that it is in the heart, because one of its powers is ascribed to that part of the body. For the motive power, of which Aristotle was treating in that book, is chiefly in the heart, by which the soul communicates movement and other like operations to the whole body.